Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. Mark Leibovich is chief national correspondent for the New York Times Magazine. He covers politics, presidents. He lives in Washington, but he has local roots here. Born in Boston, he went to Newton South High School, and he's a lifelong Patriots fan, though he admits that being a New England sports fan is not without its embarrassments. Leibovich has a new book all about the NFL, the good, the bad, the ugly about the league. He writes about the Billionaires' Owners Club, how Donald Trump wanted to join it but couldn't and had to settle for the White House instead. And he writes about the stars, including Tom Brady and Bill Belichick. The book is called Big Game, The NFL in Dangerous Times. He'll be talking about it this evening at the Harvard Bookstore in Cambridge, and he joins us now. Mark, welcome to Radio Boston. Great to have you.
Good to be with you, Anthony.
And I want to invite listeners into this conversation. We want to hear from you. Are you a football fan by birth? What do you make of the NFL? What questions do you have about the NFL? Are you concerned about player concussions, about long-term brain damage? Are you a Tom Brady fan? Will he just play forever? Give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to make the connection with Mark Leibovich about his book, The Big Game. So, as we mentioned, you've spent most of your career in journalism focusing on politics. Why football?
Well, I needed a break from politics.
Understandable.
I've been doing that nonstop for 16, 17 years. The last campaign was pretty grueling. And I've always loved football. And I wrote a book on D.C. about 5 years ago called This Town that was sort of about the end of the empire in Washington. Or not the end of the empire, but a moment when Washington seemed to be getting sort of fat and happy. And it just felt like it was teetering on something. And then all of a sudden, Donald Trump gets elected, and we have this whole new chapter and moment in Washington. Football was the same thing. It's this incredibly successful, prosperous, popular sport that seemed to be in a very precarious moment. Just there's a lot going on. I wanted to just jump in and sort of see what the similarities were, and it turned out to be just the same swamp or a different swamp, but very very familiar to the world I operate in day-to-day.
Interesting. So swampy, like the nation's capital in many ways.
In some ways, very incestuous, insular, wealthy, ego-driven, in many ways, male-driven, power-driven, and a lot of the same demons.
And speaking of that, a big part of your book talks about these NFL owners, the membership, as they call themselves, and it's basically a billionaire's boys club.
Absolutely.
So how do you describe these guys beyond that?
Well, I mean, I was fairly unimpressed with them. I mean, these are one of the great surprises to me is that one of the great undercovered stories in sports is these 32 really, really wealthy, often quite smaller than life people who own these 32 teams. And these are just coveted entities and often the most powerful entertainment entity in individual communities. And they make tons of money. And yet, obviously, Donald Trump is a great example of someone who could not get into their club. And yet they are, as one of the co-owners, Steve Tisch of the New York Giants said, it's billionaires. It's junior high school for billionaires. And you realize that, like, they have these meetings and they have all these incredibly mutual suspicions and rivalries and just these pettinesses between them. And yet they control the destinies of so many communities and they're reviled in so many towns. So it's the membership, they call themselves.
The membership, Now, why couldn't Donald Trump get into this club? What did he do to try to get into it, and why did he fail?
He did a number of things. He's been trying for four decades. He owned a USFL team in the 1980s, the New Jersey Generals, with hopes of maybe merging into the NFL. The fact is, a lot of these business people who own NFL teams have dealt with him in business over the years. They wanted no part of being business partners with him. A lot of them thought he was a clown. And, he made an effort to buy the Patriots in the 80s, made an effort to buy the Buffalo Bills in 2014. And just think, if he had gotten the Buffalo Bills, he could own the Buffalo Bills. And his fellow owners would have to worry about something else besides the White House.
Yeah, but really interesting. Now, in some ways, Trump has sort of declared war on the NFL. He's focused his anger on these players who've been taking a knee during the national anthem. I mean, do you think his inability to sort of join the membership has somehow fueled this ongoing feud?
It has to. It has to. Like, it's sort of an added sweetener to this. He thinks it's a good political issue for him. He thinks just sort of periodically saying that players need to stand for the national anthem is big with his base. He thinks it's a popular view in the country, and polls would probably back him up on that. But ultimately, the NFL fits very much into the category of institutions that had not over the years wanted Donald Trump as a member. He had his nose pressed up against the glass, and they just always wanted to keep him at a distance. So that's an added sweetener.
It's so interesting. It's so part of the Donald Trump story. I mean, you could say the same thing about sort of his political ascent, that desire to sort of get out from having his nose pressed up against the glass and be on the inside.
Be accepted.
He managed to get to the White House, but not into the membership of the NFL.
It is an amazing story in some ways. I mean, obviously, for reasons that have been told to death and will be told through history.
Yeah.
But, I mean, look, this is the Queens, you know, bridge and tunnel guy who wanted to be the elite Manhattan real estate developer and who was never really accepted by the polite society of New York and real estate. And it's just sort of football is sort of the exact same paradigm with him. And, but now he gets the ultimate consolation trophy sitting in the White House and heckling the owners.
Right? Mark Leibovich, he's author of Big Game, The NFL in Dangerous Times. We're taking your calls, 1-800-423-TALK, 1-800-423-8255. Let's go to Dave, who's calling from Brockton. Go ahead, Dave. You're on the air. Thanks for the call.
No problem. You know, I'm always amazed how every discussion ends up with Trump, no matter what we're talking about. But nevertheless, the agreement between the NFLPA and the league is going to be ending in a few years. I'm just wondering what your attitude is. Do you think the players will be bought off again like they were last time with more time off and less practicing when they want to have these other things like less control by the commissioner and social justice issues? Or you think that they finally will bite the bullet like MLB players did and like the NBA players did and take some work stoppage in order to get more money and more equity for themselves?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, I think the next CBA, collective bargaining agreement negotiations, which comes up, I think, in 2 years, is going to be just pivotal because beyond like player discipline things, which gets a lot of attention, and obviously the right to protest and things involving freedom of speech and so forth. I mean, the idea of guaranteed contracts, I think, is something that is extremely and increasingly important to NFL players. The NFL is the only major professional league in the United States that doesn't guarantee the contracts for its players, except for in a few cases. And that, to me, is like a game changer in many ways. I think Martellus Bennett, the former Patriots player, I was on his podcast. He has a podcast out in L.A. last week, and he was saying that he used to protest during the national anthem by raising his fist. And he said a lot of his teammates, especially later on with the Packers, said that they would do something like that too, but they had zero job security. And I think that that's going to be a real cornerstone issue because I think NFL players see how their fellow athletes in other sports just basically get the job security that they don't.
Thanks for that call. Mark, I want to talk, since we're in Boston talking to a greater Boston audience, I want to talk about the Patriots and Tom Brady. You don't pull any punches here. You make it very clear that you're a diehard Patriots fan, even though you bring a sort of real critical eye to this. But I love what you write about your fandom. You write, being a sports fan, generally speaking, can require a faith blind and durable. Being a Boston fan has made this easier in some ways with our gaudy prosperity of late. But the birthright is not without embarrassments. I love that. Can you just talk a little bit about what it means for you to be a Patriots fan?
Yeah. Okay. Just to step back, I wouldn't trade being a fan of this team with any other team in the league. And I'm sure there are many teams in the league that would trade being a Patriots fan because, look, no one has won as much as we have in this century, and good for us. And I mean, I'm sure we are very quick to remind fans of other teams of our success. But having said that, we do lead the league in crosses to bear. I mean, these sort of gate scandals, whether it's Spygate or Deflategate, I mean, they do take a big toll around the country. You do have to apologize for a lot of things that you might not necessarily want to have to defend, whether it's Bill Belichick's brusque manner at the podium or perhaps the arrogance of certain fans. I would never include myself in that. or the conduct of Robert Kraft. I mean, there's a lot of things. Tom Brady is not the most likable guy outside of New England either. There are a lot of things that are going to be abused and questioned and so forth. So, yeah, you do have to sort of hold your breath a little bit and say, yes, we're on the right side here. But ultimately, the New England Patriots, I think, are hated and resented in a way that other dynasties in football history, whether the Pittsburgh Steelers or the San Francisco 49ers, have not been.
And is that just because they've won so much and they're so dominant, or there's something else going
on
there?
No, because other teams have won just as well, almost as much.
Right.
I think there is something else going on there. I think part of it is social media. I think part of it is their today's dynasty. It's also lasted a lot longer than Pittsburgh, San Francisco, Green Bay, I mean, any of these dynasties. I mean, it's gone for 18, 19 years. They are just there. And it's also, it coincides with an era of media saturation where there are so many games on TV, and the Patriots, I mean, I know this as someone who doesn't live in Boston, I live in Washington. I mean, I can watch them for free, which is nice, all the time because they're just all over the place. So people are sick of them. And then you have a divisive figure like Donald Trump adopting them as his own, which, no matter where you are on the political spectrum, is going to create great friction and baggage and divisiveness around your team, whether you want it or not. So, again, there's a lot of noise around the Patriots that can become exhausting if you want to be defensive about
it. I want to ask you about your experience of sort of tracking down Tom Brady and actually finally getting an interview with him. And as you're on your way to his fabulous penthouse apartment in Manhattan, you actually admit that you're sort of more nervous with the prospect of meeting Tom Brady than you ever have been as you've spoken to presidents or whoever else it is.
It was a bizarre thing. I mean, I have interviewed presidents, I've interviewed CEOs, I've interviewed even interviewed the former host of The Apprentice. I mean, I legitimately within a few months of this first interview I had with Brady, I spent three solid weeks, or not three solid weeks, but a long time, you know, talking to then front runner Donald Trump. But yeah, being in the presence of your childhood hero or someone that you associate with a childhood pursuit, whether it's pro football, was amazing. I was just really nervous walking in there, and I was sweating, and I hope I didn't like completely embarrass myself.
It's funny that you mentioned that. I was telling you this before we went on the air. You know, I've been able to talk to a few sort of powerful folks as well, and not long ago I was at an event for WBUR, and I was in the green room with Pedro Martinez, and I was suddenly like just this blob of jello. It's like, oh my God, you're Pedro Martinez. I can't believe it.
It is. You revert to being like a 7-year-old, you know, again. I mean, there was a bizarre, I mean, it is amazing. I remember, I write about this in the book, going to the Hall of Fame induction ceremonies a couple of years ago in Canton, Ohio, and all the gold jackets, all the inductees come back. And Tony Dorsett, who I remember, you know, seeing when I was growing up, Hall of Fame running back for the Dallas Cowboys, I just ran right up to him and said, I'll never forget seeing that 99-yard run from scrimmage you had on Monday Night Football against Minnesota. And he came right back and he said, yes, of course. There were only 10 men on the field, you know, because Ron Springs, the fullback, was confused, and he went up. He didn't come onto the field. And by the way, that record can never be broken. It can only be tied because, of course, you cannot start a play from the end zone.
Yeah.
And, of course, yeah, the other side of this is I've read enough about Tony Dorsett over the years to know that this guy has had terrible cognitive damage and physical damage from his career in football. He can't remember what he did 10 minutes ago. He has full-time help. And yet he remembers such great detail about what he did on a night in 1979.
Yeah.
And so there is that sort of constant kind of bittersweetness of you know, experiencing that.
Oh, well, I want to ask you specifically sort of what that was like when you finally did start talking to Tom Brady and getting to know him. But let's take another call. Woody is calling from Westwood. Woody, go ahead. You're on the air. Thanks for the call.
Hi, thanks. Good to talk to a fellow new tonight. I was wondering, being a diehard Patriot, if you had any thoughts about whether Bill Belichick has fallen off the cliff. Why he didn't put Butler in? What his relationship is now with Brady and Kraft?
Great question.
So Butler, of course, this is the last Super Bowl.
Yes, Malcolm Butler, the cornerback who was kept on the bench inexplicably, into this day we don't know why, arguably cost them the game because the Patriots could not get off the field. Look, I think there's a lot of noise now. I mean, there's a new book about Belichick by Ian O'Connor, an ESPN writer, that has a lot of people talking about the frictions between him and Robert Kraft and Brady. I mean, I do think that this Malcolm Butler story, I mean, if you go back 3-4 years and that out-of-nowhere interception he had in the Super Bowl, which was legitimately one of the top 3 or 4 maybe greatest sports moments or NFL moments in a Super Bowl in history. A guy who was a rookie, an undrafted free agent, just coming out of nowhere and just totally changing the game. And then, you know, achieving great success out of nowhere. And then all of a sudden, on the exact same stage, what was it, 2 years later? No, 3 years later, having something inexplicable happened. And look, I, as a fan, resent the fact that Bill Belichick has never explained to us what was going on. Because, look, this is not national security. Everyone cares about it.
He grunted about it a couple of times.
You know what? I don't, as a consumer, I do not appreciate that part of the act.
Yeah.
But look, he's smarter than all of us, so he can do what he wants.
Right. So what was that, what was that meeting with Brady like? Because he's notoriously private. He doesn't do many interviews. You managed to get in there. What was your impression of him?
You know, remarkably normal. I mean, he's not, I mean, for his abnormally talented and good-looking and wealthy and married to a supermodel-y as he is, he's pretty down to earth. He's actually capable of incredible thoughtfulness on topics that he cares about, whether it's training issues and nutrition issues or certainly football issues. He's much more curious than I thought. He actually asked me a ton of questions about what it's like to be around politicians, what politicians are like, because he, I think like a lot of people, thinks that that life is just insane. I'm like, what does it take to succeed in politics? What do you have to sacrifice? What do you have to go through? Because obviously it's not completely dissimilar to what a sports celebrity has to go through, in that you're very isolated in some ways, you're very pampered in some ways, and you're under a lot of scrutiny in many ways. So I was struck by that. He also is, I don't think it's fully appreciated the degree to which he's just very counterintuitive in how he sees the world. He's caught quite a bit of criticism for his reliance on these alternative diets and medicine and you know, training methods with Alex Guerrero, his somewhat controversial body coach. But ultimately, he's a different kind of thinker. He has always sort of thought, he has a very, Don Yee, his agent, is not a typical NFL agent. He's someone he hired, you know, when he came out of college and is stuck with. Don, who's the one who originally put me in touch with Brady, is someone who, you know, is not a, he's just very, very, he has an Eastern philosophy on things. So Tom is just a, he is willing to take on the industrial complex of football, and I appreciate that.
And what's your take on just his extraordinary longevity? I mean, correlation doesn't mean causation, but he does these weird diets and TB12, and you mentioned Guerrero, and I mean, in one sense, the proof is in the pudding. I mean, here he is at 41, still playing at a top level. What explains that?
I would think a lot of things. I mean, one, obviously, his work ethic is extraordinary. His commitment to this is extraordinary. I think he plays a position that is relatively protected on the field. I think other than being a kicker, I mean, being a quarterback, given the rules protecting quarterbacks, is a pretty relatively safe proposition, especially Tom is not someone who scrambles. I mean, there have been a lot of quarterbacks that have had a lot of concussion issues, but they were scrambling quarterbacks, like Troy Aikman, Steve Young, Warren Moon, Brett Favre in the 90s. I mean, there's this whole generation of Hall of Fame quarterbacks who have had this, so or had all kinds of issues. So I think that, I think it's luck. I think part of it is also when you get so smart about what you do for a living and are able to release the ball so quickly and are able to think so much quicker than anyone else, you probably afford yourself a lot more physical kind of leeway because you can sort of move around the field more. But look, I think a lot of it is luck, and I think if he takes, God forbid, a really, really serious hit on Sunday against Detroit, it could change the whole thing.
Hmm. I want to ask you, sort of come back to the NFL in general, sort of ask you a sort of big sweeping question about sort of the challenges that the NFL faces, whether it's sort of this political feud with the president, bad PR, concerns around concussions, brain damage. Are they set up? Returning to this membership, are they set up in such a way that they can deal with these challenges? And if not, what happens to the NFL?
I think they've been lucky for a long time. I think they've been very powerful for a long time. I think they're a classic example of a monopoly organization that has all kinds of leverage that has benefited them in broadcast contracts, in labor negotiating contracts, and so forth. I think, you know, if I were betting on them, if I were like, if they were a public company, which obviously they're not, but I was buying shares, I think that like their recent track record is obviously growth and success and prosperity, but I think there are a lot of serious long-term, you know, lags on their ability to continue to be as successful as they have. I mean, health and safety, the workforce and young people is going to go down considerably, it looks like. And also, if you look at the last few years, there were moments, like in the last 5 years alone, where things just looked like they were spiraling out of control, and they didn't have a clue. The Ray Rice video in 2014.
Right, domestic abuse allegations.
Having a president that tweets, I mean, they don't know what to do. So my basic takeaway here is that the NFL will survive because it's a great game and a great TV sport, but it will do so in spite of the people who run and own it.
Not because of them.
Right.
All right. That's Mark Leibovich, chief national correspondent for the New York Times Magazine. He's author of Big Game, the NFL in Dangerous Times. And Mark will be holding a Q&A tonight at the Harvard Bookstore at 7 p.m. You can find more information at radioboston.org. Mark, thanks so much for coming in.
And thanks for having me.
The book.
This is fun. Okay.
That's it. Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.